This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Animal Week on Fresh Air, featuring interviews about animals and people who work with and study them. Temple Grandin has written extensively about autism and the connection she sees between the behavior of people with autism and animal behavior. Grandin is autistic. When she was young, doctors recommended that she be institutionalized, but her mother refused. Grandin has worked to educate people about what it's like to live with autism. She's also fought for reforms in the livestock industry. She has her doctorate in animal science, teaches courses on livestock behavior and facility design at Colorado State University, and consults with the livestock industry on livestock handling and animal welfare. She spent a lot of her career designing humane handling facilities for farm animals. I recorded this interview with her last January after the publication of her book, Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. Temple Grandin, welcome back to Fresh Air. As we've discussed before in the show, you see similarities between animal behavior and autism. And in your new book, you say that, you know, one of the signs that an animal may be troubled is if they're engaging in really repetitive, compulsive behavior. What are some of those behaviors, and how does that relate to autism, too, in humans?
Well, when I was a little kid, I used to do stereotypic or repetitive behaviors. I'd sit for hours and dribble sand through my hands. Sometimes I rocked. Some children afflict the fingers in front of their eyes. I did this because loud sounds hurt my ears. So I did it to escape the loud sounds. And then I would just get fascinated watching all little sand grains, you know, go through my fingers, you know, sort of studying them like a scientist. And the thing is, if I'd been allowed to do that all day, I wouldn't be here now doing an interview. I don't know where I would be. Stereotypic behavior, repetitive behavior is highly abnormal. But there's different things that can motivate it. And this is the basis of the first chapter in the book. And I need to give my co-author, Catherine Johnson, credit for coming up with the idea of linking stereotypic behavior motivation back to Jack Panksepp's core emotions, which are fear, rage, separation anxiety, and seeking. And when I first started out, fear motivated me to do the stereotypic behavior because the loud sounds made me scared. And then seeking would take over, and I would just study the little grains of sand. I want to say that, you know, repetitive behavior is extremely abnormal. The nervous system is not working normally when an animal or a person is doing hours of repetitive stereotypies.
What are some of the typical, like, animal repetitive behaviors that are a sign that something's wrong? Like, we've all known dogs who chase their tail endlessly. Would that be an example?
That would be an example of pacing in a lion or a polar bear. A tongue rolling. Recently I saw some Jersey cows putting their heads up in the air and just waggling their tongues all around. That's totally abnormal. A gerbil that just sits in the corner digging and digging and digging constantly. That's abnormal. The main thing about a stereotypy is it's just sort of is exactly the same over and over and over again. An animal that's pacing will, you know, wear down the floor right where he paces.
So how did you break out of your repetitive behaviors, like, you know, watching grains of sand or rocking back and forth?
I had very good early education starting at 2.5, and I was only allowed to have an hour a day where I could do that sort of thing. And when I was in my bedroom, I'd spin this little brass thingamajig round and round and round that was on the bed frame. The rest of the time, I was kept tuned in. Speech therapy, hours of turn-taking games. I was expected to sit at the table and have table manners and pass the potatoes when they needed to be passed. You know, everybody worked with me to keep my brain connected to the world. I was allowed to only have an hour a day after lunch where I could space out and revert back to autism.
And was that a pleasurable hour?
Yes, that's the thing about it, is stereotypies actually are pleasurable. They calm you down. And I think it's okay for an autistic kid to have a little bit of downtime where they can do these things and calm down. But if you let them do it all day, they're never going to get anywhere because the brain is shutting out the world.
So do you feel like you have any insights about how to break animals of that kind of, you know, like repetitive compulsive behavior?
Well, you've got to start looking at what does that animal do in the wild. You take the polar bear, he's a nomad animal. He walks for miles and miles and miles and miles. Grazing animals like cattle tend to get mouth stereotypies because what do they do all day? They eat. Gerbils will get into digging stereotypies. But what gets interesting is looking at the motivation. A polar bear he's seeking stuff to do. That's why he walks and walks and walks. Now, the gerbil, they thought, okay, let's make a good environment for a gerbil. Let's just give him more sand to dig in. Well, he still spends all 30% of his day digging and digging and digging. You know, but what the gerbil really wants is a place to hide because it's a prey species animal. And he's trying to dig a hole in the bottom of the aquarium, and he can't make a tunnel. Well, if you give him a tunnel, even a fake one, he'll go in there. That gives him cover. And he's digging because he feels exposed. You know, that stereotypy was motivated by fear, where the stereotypy in the polar bear was motivated by seeking.
In your new book, Animals Make Us Human, you describe cats as having a high level of OCD behavior, obsessive-compulsive disorder behavior. What are some examples of that that you see?
Well, you can get a laser pointer out there, and boy, the cat won't stop chasing it. Now, some cats don't go after a laser pointer, but there are some cats, you get a laser pointer, they're just obsessed. In fact, you have to be careful with a laser pointer not to injure a cat, because he can get so much into chasing that little red dot that he can injure himself if you're not careful about how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that can get kind of weird is sometimes a cat can't figure out how to get out of a tree. I had a weird situation when I was a child with our Siamese cat. We had one of these old-fashioned dishwashers that pulled out like a big file drawer, and Billy got underneath the dishwasher, and he was pawing out through the crack out into the kitchen, meowing, trying to go forward. All he had to do to get out was to just back up and, you know, go out around and come out from underneath the sink, and he couldn't figure out how to do that, so I had to slowly, very, very slowly push the dishwasher in to very slowly let him back up and get out.
Now, one of the things you've been doing for many years is consulting to the livestock industry on humane handling of livestock. You've consulted on cattle, pigs, chickens. Anything I'm leaving out?
Sheep, I've done some.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think the first animals you worked with like that were cows. And you built humane chutes to get the cows to slaughter. In doing this kind of work, and in trying to find humane ways of keeping the livestock while they're alive and getting them to slaughter when they're killed, you've had to really understand how animals process information and how their senses compare to human senses, because some things that would upset animals wouldn't upset us. So unless we understand what upsets animals, we can't design humane systems for them. Let's start with cows. Can you compare what you know about how cows process information and what they find upsetting in terms of what they hear or see or smell that most humans would not?
Animals, I mean, especially cattle, notice visual detail, things that move rapidly, things that are high contrast. When I first started out working with the slaughter plants, I had to figure out, do they know they're getting slaughtered? So I'd go over to the Swift plant in Arizona, this was back in the early 70s, and then I'd go out down to a feed yard and watch them in the vaccinating chute, and they behaved exactly the same way. And then I started to figure out, what are they really scared of? So I'd get down in the chutes and see what they were seeing, and they were scared of shadows, reflections, a chain hanging down, seeing a person walking by up in the front of the chute. And if you got rid of these things that the animals are afraid of, and the animals will walk right up the chute really, really easily. I'm still doing that kind of consulting. Just last week, I went out to two plants, and in one of them, I found five distractions that were causing cattle to balk that they had not seen. And they were simple things, a moving yellow hose, some spraying water, a flashing light. They were simple things, but they just didn't see them.
So what happens if cattle see a yellow light or a moving hose or something that distracts them and actually scares them as they're on their way to slaughter? I mean, they're going to get killed, right? So why are we worried that they're going to be a little upset beforehand?
Well, you could say the same thing. You know, you get some old grandmother in a nursing home and say, well, let's just throw her over in the corner. She's going to die of cancer tomorrow. That doesn't matter. I mean, it gets back to relieving suffering, and there's no reason for it to be scary. In fact, there's been some research on the cortisol, the stress levels at the slaughterhouse and at the farm vaccinating chute. Yes, there is stress in both places. It's the same in both places.
You found that a lot of employees, both at livestock facilities and at slaughterhouses, don't really believe that animals have emotions.
Well, actually, the hourly employees aren't the ones that are a problem. It's some of these business manager types. I remember one time a vice president of a great big pig company said, asked me in all seriousness, do pigs have emotions? Well, if you look at the structure of the brain, that's really pretty silly, because the emotional circuits, let's get back to these core emotions of fear, rage, separation, anxiety, and seeking, these are subcortical brain systems. They are the same in all mammals. They have been completely mapped. Some of that research by Jack Panskap and others was done back in the 60s. I can remember in the 60s in psychology class learning about the rage cat. You know, you put electrode in the rage center and the cat goes into a rage.
My guest is Temple Grandin. She's written extensively about how being autistic has given her insights into animal behavior. Her latest book is called Animals Make Us Human. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Temple Grandin, and she's written a lot about autism, a condition that she has. And she's also written a lot about the connection between animals and autism. And her new book is called Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. You've consulted about cattle. You've also consulted about pigs. What's some of the worst things that you found about the condition that pigs are typically kept in, the pigs who are bred for their meat?
One of my biggest concerns is overloading the biological system. Just pushing, pushing, pushing for more and more and more production to the point where the biological system just starts to fall apart. Bone problems, metabolic problems, weakness. You can push it genetically too hard. You can push it too hard with feed additives and hormones. But this is one of my biggest concerns. I mean, right now, for example, I mean, huge numbers of sows, the mother pigs are lame, and it's just structurally bad legs. You know, the pig companies are starting to correct some of that. But I'm very concerned about this. I'm very concerned about some of the bad dog breeding that's going on, where we just, you know, overselect some stupid appearance trait, or you just overselect for giant muscles or giant milk production. They've got the dairy cow so overselected for milk production now that you have a hard time getting her bred. The embryo just doesn't take.
So because pigs have been bred to create the most meat, we're ending up with, like, physical defects like legs that can't support their weight?
Well, it can support the weight, but you just don't have what's called good leg conformation. You know, you can, I don't want to get into all the different things on leg conformation, but they can be too straight. They can be, you know, the little dew claw things can collapse and they'll be walking on the dew claws. And the bottom line is the end up lame. And I think with all animals, we need to be looking at having, you know, animals that are structurally sound and animals that are mentally sound. You know, some of when we bred the chicken for more and more and more and more eggs. One of the problems was a hyper-excitable chicken. When the pigs were bred, they'd just be super lean. Some of the genetic lines of the super lean pigs were real hyper-excitable.
So what are some of the things you've tried to do to improve the conditions of pigs?
Well, my biggest thing with all the animals is working on handling. I've done a lot of work with many different companies on, you know, loading trucks, you know, how do you handle pigs, training people on handling of animals, the stockmanship. Stockmanship is really, really important. There's been research on stockmanship by Paul Hemsworth, Jeffrey Rushen.
What is stockmanship?
Stockmanship is just being good at animal care. Mm-hmm. Like you work with your animals in such a way that your animals are not afraid of you. Because if your dairy cows are afraid of you or your pigs are afraid of you, they don't grow as well, they don't reproduce as well, they don't give as much milk.
So how do pigs compare to cows, and what scares them, and what therefore what you try to eliminate from their world?
Well, obviously, you want to totally eliminate people that are slapping and hitting and doing those kind of things. But there's differences in how pigs will react, even with two stockmen that are pretty good stockmen. I remember on one farm, there was a guy, and he was, you know, good stockman. He never abused the animals. But then when they got a new lady in the barn to take care of the baby piglets, you know, they actually had more litters weaned, and the sows just felt more relaxed around the lady than they did around the guy.
And what are some of the changes that you've recommended in the handling and the living conditions of pigs?
Well, in handling, just, you know, basic things, move smaller groups, no yelling and screaming. A lot of it's very basic. You know, then they need to learn things like flight zone and point of balance. If you want an animal to go forward, I don't care what species it is, you don't stand in front of the head and poke it on the butt, because now you're telling that animal to go forward and backwards at the same time. You've got to get behind the point of balance at the animal's shoulder, get beyond the behind the shoulder, then it's going to go forward. Just teaching them some of the behavioral principles about animals. And, you know, some people have the temperament to work with animals, and some don't. There's some people that shouldn't be working with animals. But then on the other hand, to have good stockmanship, you can't have a place that's understaffed and where they're overworked, because there's no way that, you know, they can be good at taking care of the animals.
One of the things you've been doing in the livestock industry is creating audits to basically measure the welfare of cows and pigs and chickens. What's an audit like?
Well, basically, you manage things that you measure. You know, you manage weight gain, but nobody's measuring handling. One of my biggest frustrations is I'd go out to a farm or I'd go out to a slaughter plant and I'd get their handling really good, and they're using an electric prod, hardly any at all. And then I'd come back a year later and the handling was awful. And what had happened is they slowly reverted back to those old rough methods, but they didn't realize it. So the concept that I brought into it was measuring handling. Okay, how many pigs fall down? How many pigs are squealing? How many pigs did you use the electric prod on? If you measure it and count that, then you can tell, is my handling getting better or is my handling getting worse? And I developed an audit system called the American Meat Institute Guideline. Did that about 10 years ago, and that's used by McDonald's and other big companies to audit this slaughter plants. And you go in and you count, you know, how many times they use the prod. Well, sometimes people act good when you're there. So the big new frontier right now is video auditing with video cameras, with people looking in at the handling at the plant over the internet and then scoring it.
So this is done over time, and it's not like, oh, we'll just make everything look good for the one day when Temple Grandin visits, and then we'll go back.
That prevents that kind of problem, because on these video auditing systems, they'll maybe two times a day, you know, they'll score maybe, you know, 20 cattle or, you know, score a few animals, and they never know when they're looking.
Mm-hmm.
And there's five plants now on this system, and it's been going really well.
Now, you've also consulted to the poultry industry. Have you come up with ways to improve poultry slaughter?
Well, one of the big things I've done on that, again, is the measurement system. When I first started working with poultry, I remember going out to this farm. They were catching chickens. It was terrible, running them over with a forklift. And they thought it was normal to have 5 to 6% of the birds having a broken wing. I was watching what they were doing. I go, this is just rough handling. So then in one of the plants, we started measuring it. And we very quickly got it down to 1%. And one of the best ways to clean that up is to put the catching crews on incentive pay. Like each person might get an extra $30 a week if they don't bust up the chickens. And again, just simple measurement improved a lot of things.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Temple Grandin, and she's written extensively about her life with autism. She's written about the connections that she thinks exist between animals and animal behavior and autistic behavior. Her latest book is called Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. You've written about how, because you do have autism, you don't really like physical contact with people. You've chosen to avoid romantic love in your life. You choose to live alone. What about kind of physical contact with animals? Do you enjoy petting them? Do you enjoy things like a cat sitting in your lap and snuggling up against you?
Yes, and I really enjoy stroking an animal. And you don't want to pat an animal. You want to stroke it, kind of just firm strokes like mother's tongue. And I really get a lot of enjoyment if I can stroke an animal and the animal's obviously liking it. Like the kitty will rub up against me and the dog is, Mark, my assistant, had a little dog named Annie. And all she wanted to do when she saw me was to roll over on her belly and have me scratch her belly. And, you know, cattle sometimes, you rub them on the neck just right, they put their head up in the air and they kind of go, oh, that just feels so good. I do get pleasure out of, you know, stroking an animal and seeing that animal get happy when you do it.
What else gives you pleasure beyond work?
Talking about autism with other people, talking about animals with other people, talking about engineering with other people, talking about really interesting stuff. And I can relate to another lady that's got Asperger's. she was giving a talk, and she was telling me that, you know, she and her husband have this great romantic dinners and really nice restaurant with candles and everything else. And that sets the stage for a beautiful romantic conversation on computer data storage systems.
I love it.
Because that's just so interesting. And I can completely relate to that.
Well, Temple Grandin, I really want to thank you for talking with us and coming to Fresh Air again. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Temple Grandin recorded last January after the publication of her book, Animals Make Us Human. Our Animal Week series continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.